You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. For those of you I have not had the honor of meeting yet, my name is John Allen, and I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you all today to appear with our featured guest, our honored guest, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General David H. Berger. General Berger assumed his duties as the 38th Commandant of the Marine Corps on the 11th of July, 2019. A career infantry officer, as we say in the Corps, hoorah, he served on behalf of his country and in uniform for over 30 years. Upon his commissioning in 1981, General Berger served across multiple theaters in Europe, the Indo-Pacific region, and the Middle East, notably serving in operations like Secure Tomorrow in Haiti, or Operation Iraqi Freedom in Fallujah, or Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. General Berger draws on a wealth of tactical and strategic experience in his current position. Before becoming commandant, he served as the commander of the Marine Corps Combat Development Command, and there he garnered a reputation for being one of the leading architects in preparing our Corps in the era of great power competition. Today, General Berger continues this kind of innovative leadership in his role as commandant. Already, he's implemented an ambitious modernization agenda and a new force design. It's an integrated approach. More than just about units and equipment, it's about the concepts and the doctrine, and it's about investing in modernization consistent with competing, deterring, and if necessary, fighting and winning in a multi-domain conflict, an environment that is profoundly affected by the dynamic, changing character of war, all at a time when the U.S. is challenged and competing with near peer competitors with extraordinary and historic symmetric and asymmetric capabilities. It's a tall order, and General Berger certainly has his work cut out for him. Still, it's the kind of strategic thinking that we've come to expect from this great Marine general, but it's also the kind of strategic thinking we've come to expect from our Marines in their modern history, and will undoubtedly be essential if we're to ensure the safety and the security of America and our allies in the 21st century. So, Commandant, it's good to see you again, sir. And on behalf of all of us at Brookings, we are honored to host you today for this crucial online conversation. We certainly hope that this will not be the last time you engage with us, and the next time, we hope it is in person. So now moving to the day's events, once I've completed my remarks, I'll turn the floor over to our Brookings Senior Fellow, Mike O'Hanlon, from the Foreign Policy Program, who will moderate the conversation with General Berger. And after the dialogue, Mike will open the floor to questions and answers from our audience. Should audience members like to submit questions, they're welcome to do so via our address at brookings.edu, or sorry, events@brookings.edu, or via Twitter at #MarineCorps. And also, this is a very live and recorded and streamed program today. So with that, I'd like to turn the floor over to Mike and General Berger, as always, Semper Fidelis, sir.
General Berger, thank you for joining us as well. Let me also join John Allen, for whom we're privileged to work at Brookings, and we get to benefit from a little bit of the Marine Corps style of leadership. Not too many 5:30 a.m. push-up sessions, but otherwise a lot of the same charisma, energy, and commitment to the country that you exemplify. And again, I wanted to thank you for joining us just as John Allen did. And to begin by asking you, before we get into the discussion about the future, which of course I think is a lot of what your tenure as Commandant has already focused on, I wanted to ask you about the state of the Marine Corps today and how you see the men and women, uniformed and civilian, who are doing so much for our country as Marines or part of the broader Marine community. And, you know, we've been through more than a year of COVID. You folks have done amazing things, but I wanted to hear not only your accomplishments and your sense of what's going well, but any concerns you have about readiness, about recruiting and retention, just about the state of the force. If we could please begin, sir, with that. And again, welcome to Brookings. Thank you for joining us today. Over to you.
As I mentioned before we went live, I'm under no small amount of pressure when one of your lifelong mentors is watching you and introducing you. So but Marines are taught to handle pressure. So I'll try to do my best here. The state of the Corps today, I think I'm very comfortable with where it is right now, although it clearly the service and the Department of Defense are in a period of change, and always with change comes some, you know, some unease, some uncertainty. Readiness wise, I think pretty clear. In 3 or 4 years ago, General Neller, my predecessor, spoke with Congress and told them, here's where we are coming out of the Middle East. We need to rebuild our readiness. And Congress provided that the resources to do that. So for 3 years, stable funding, good resources, he rebuilt the readiness with Congress and General Neller rebuilt the readiness of the Marine Corps. So today, we're a ready Marine Corps. It also set us up for the modernization, which you hinted at. The past year has had, no doubt, has had some challenges. But like in combat, I think in the past 12 months has also given Marine leaders and Marines an opportunity to shine, because there's no book that they could read. How do you move the Marine Corps through a pandemic? How do you recruit? How do you do recruit training? All that, there was no book for that. But as always, they adapt, they improvise, they rely on the non-commissioned officers and junior officers, and we very much trust that they made great decisions. They make great decisions along the way, and they did. For example, I think a year ago would have been safest, most conservative, if we had stopped recruiting, stopped recruit training, and sort of figure it out for a month or two. You know, after listening to the recruiting force and listening to the training pipeline, they were pretty clear. No, we can sort this out. We can figure this out. Just give us the tools and we'll run with it. And of course, that's what happened. But it is really hard to recruit when the high schools are closed, when the colleges are shuttered. So they really went in a different direction. But I think long term, in a lot of other areas in the private sector as well, some of those techniques and tools that were picked up over the past 12 months will carry forward with, because they're useful. They add to this sort of toolkit. I think the Marine Corps today, very ready. It is clearly, we're running the Marine Corps, we're running the Department of Defense at a pretty good clip based on security issues around the world, but that's not new. You have seen that for the entirety of your watching over the national security sort of portfolio. I don't think that's new. We're just benefiting from a few years of rebuilt readiness, where now we can move to the modernization part you highlighted. I think the people are in good shape. The tempo has adjusted itself into a sort of a status where we can maintain the tempo of deployments and time home and then deployments again. In other words, we're not burning out the individuals. It's not laid back, but we're not burning them out either. So I think overall, we're in a very good place where we could respond to a crisis anywhere on the globe. We're in a good place in terms of doing the business that combatant commanders need us to do to deter something from growing into a bigger problem. But clearly the pressing threat of both the People's Republic of China and Russia are driving us to modernize and adjust for the future.
Thank you. And as I start talking about modernization with you and asking you some questions there, if I could, as a transition question, ask you about the budget trajectory, where I think you've had some comments in public already, but are you comfortable with the notion that it looks likely that the defense budget is not going to keep growing in real terms in the years ahead? I mean, who knows? I don't want to say that's an iron law of physics, but certainly the last Trump budget, the early Biden budgets, the mood of the Congress, the fiscal concerns from COVID response, all of this would seem to be pushing the country towards what looks like an emerging consensus that we should sort of keep the defense budget flat. There's some people who would cut it a lot, some people who would like to restore the 3-5% annual real growth that Secretary Mattis and others called for with the National Defense Strategy of 2018. But it seems like we're more likely to be more or less flat, with or without adjustments for inflation. Can you live with that as Commandant?
A couple things to unpack there. First, our approach for the past 2 years has been that before we went to Congress to ask for any increase in resources, which we may need to do, but before we took that step, that we would self-fund, we would resource ourselves to modernize, which we have done. There's a risk in that because your counterparts, the other services, are asking for a larger budget and they're asking for an increase in end strength. The last couple of years, we did not go that path. And my thinking, my logic was, Michael, that if you're going to anticipate perhaps asking for some additional resources down the road, you have to be able to demonstrate that you have wrung every bit of efficiency and modernized inside to the best you can before you ask for another dollar. That's where we are. The size of the budget versus the trajectory of the budget. You introduced both. I would say the third part I would say would probably be the stability of the budget. The three elements that a service chief kind of focuses on. Of the three, stability is the most important. In other words, I can adjust the service if we have a good forecast going forward. If it's up and down, really difficult, the size of the budget we can adjust to. I think overall, the Department of Defense, you know, that's the size of the budget is really the Secretary of Defense's, you know, focus with Congress, and he can he's in a great position, of course, to describe with Congress what the needs are. But as a service, if you can't, first of all, just the basics of economics, which everybody on the net is going to clearly understand. If you can't match the rate of inflation, then your buying power is going down. That's a challenge. That means you're going to continue to contract. You're going to delay modernization. You're going to do what you need to do to keep readiness up in the near term. So our approach in shrinking the size of the Marine Corps and divesting of legacy older equipment has allowed us to modernize at a fast rate. Going forward, I think but my anticipation was that it was going to be flat, that we were not going to be on a climbing trajectory for the next 4 or 5 years. So I think we are set up okay. As a Department of Defense, you know, that's really for the Secretary to decide how much the overall size of the budget is and the piece of it. The most pressing part for me as a service chief is the stability, is the what can I forecast looking downrange.
And just to give you a chance to highlight a couple of the efficiencies and tough decisions that you've made, if I could, you know, I've been reviewing your testimonies and your previous articles and so forth. At least two big things that come to my mind that you probably want to add to. One would be a reduction in headquarters staff, where you've been aspiring to cut by maybe 15%. And another would be a much reduced emphasis on tanks as a key integral part of Marine Corps firepower. And then maybe a third part would be shifting away over time from some of the large amphibious ships to a somewhat smaller approach towards moving Marines and their equipment around the globe. Although that part I sense is maybe more of a work in progress. But could you maybe add to my list with any other reforms that you think the general public needs to be more fully aware of regarding the Marine Corps to date?
The capabilities that you mentioned, the major programs like heavy armor, towed artillery, heavy bridging capability, which were all very useful for the last 50 years and would be useful going forward to some degree. We have to make this, you know, my assessment is you have to make trades based on what you think your utility is to the joint force. So we are willing to trade the things like heavy armor for capabilities that I think are unique to the Marine Corps that provide a unique contribution to the combatant commander, to the joint force. And that is the expeditionary, the amphibious, the parts that we do very good, very better than anybody else. So divesting of the capabilities you mentioned, part of it. Part of it was contracting the end strength, shrinking the end strength of the Marine Corps, because people are expensive. And we have to match the size of the Marine Corps to what we think we're going to be asked to do in the future. So people, the second part. In other words, I know it's an oversimplification, but I am willing to trade capacity and strength for quality of the Marine Corps that we have. So we'll have a slightly smaller Marine Corps in terms of end strength, but they will be more senior and better trained. So that's a trade I'm willing to make. Where we have to go in terms of capabilities that we don't have right now, we have to be able to help the fleet commander, the joint force commander, against a peer or near peer adversary. And that means things like anti-ship, anti-subsurface capabilities, in other words, that we need to develop that helps them first deter, as you pointed out. So shrinking the size of the Marine Corps, divesting of some legacy programs, all important. The civilian headquarters, 15% reduction, I think, as hard as that will be, essential also, because you can't shrink the muscle of the Marine Corps, the real muscle, and then still keep the headquarters the same size it was before. It doesn't make sense. So we should right size that as well. So overall, trying to right size the Marine Corps, divest of older platforms and capabilities that were perhaps useful going forward. The last part you mentioned was ships. I would say it's not a trade of one or the other. We're going to need L-class amphibious ships, LHAs, going forward, because they're so versatile when you can launch F-35s or MV-22s and surface vessels on the water. You can do all of that from one ship. I mean, they are, as General Allen knows and other people have commented on, they are literally the Swiss Army knives. They can do everything. But we also need the organic mobility of much smaller ships, lower draft, that can move a smaller unit around in a littoral, in a kind of an island area, over and make that organic mobility available to them. So we need a wider portfolio, I would say. It's not an either or.
By the way, on the Navy ships that move you around in large numbers already today, of course, as you say, they can carry airplanes. They're big compared to some of the other ships you just mentioned. They're small compared to the classic flat deck aircraft carrier. Do you think we can make greater use of these Marine Corps carriers, if you will, sometimes as a substitute for the flat deck? Secretary Mattis was trying to get away from always having an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, partly because he wanted to be able to focus them more on Russia and China. Is there still room for greater flexibility and maybe a greater change in how we deploy forces abroad, maybe using Marine Corps assets and the smaller carriers that you operate on, rather than using the big flat decks in certain scenarios?
I think the choices give a combatant commander options. An amphibious ship, even an LHA America class, is not an aircraft carrier, and an aircraft carrier is not an amphibious ship. I think the value, in other words, in changing it up sometimes is it does provide the unpredictability that Mattis talked about, where, you know, to our allies, to our partners, we want to become very predictable, but to an adversary, you want to be unpredictable. So I think the employment of both embarked Marines on amphibious ships and aircraft carriers at different times, very powerful, because it makes it very difficult for an adversary to see a pattern that's recognizable that they can set up, you know, something to counter. I think both have a place, both have a role. And we rely really on the joint force commanders, the combatant commanders, to ask for the right capability at the right time. And my job as a service chief, give them as much on a menu as we can.
Looking to that question, I've been intrigued, and I know you've been thinking a lot about the future of warfare and the way in which the combatant commanders work with the service chiefs, the chairman, the secretary, the Congress, to build the force of the future. And one thing I'm struck by is that service chiefs really have to play a huge role in this, and I'm personally thrilled that you do, because the combatant commander, as much as they're thinking about war plans, they're also thinking about day-to-day. And from where I sit, I sometimes worry that combatant commanders get too caught up in the day-to-day, you know, maintaining deterrence and reassurance and presence and symbolic shows of resolve. And also sometimes war plans that were created in an earlier era of technology and warfare sort of survive longer than they should, which brings me to really my central question that I'd like to put to you and then maybe explore a little further in follow-up. As you think about deterring China and Russia, but perhaps especially China given the Marine Corps' maritime responsibilities. Can you help me start to understand the kinds of scenarios that you worry about most? Are you thinking about Chinese attacks on Taiwan, where I'm not really sure if the Marine Corps role is enormous in that scenario? Or are you thinking more about Chinese, movement into the South China Sea or the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, even more than we've seen so far? Or don't you really think in those kind of specific scenario, specific terms, and you're thinking more generally about just a broad region where we may have to compete, show presence, work with partners, and you're less focused on combat scenarios? Can you give us a little window into what's driving you as you think about the future of warfare and especially about the future of deterring China so we don't have to fight them?
The first part, the temporal nature or the different lenses that combatant commanders view their challenges through versus service chiefs. I would agree with you 100%. Their horizon is clearly closer in than the service chiefs. Their risk is more near term. So they're going to try to reduce that risk, buy down that risk by being as big and strong and prevent anything from bubbling up right away on their watch. So I don't fault them at all. I'm sure I would be doing pretty much the same. The service chief, I've settled into, I think my horizon, the way that I can help best is keep a horizon that's about 10 years out. So every day, every week, my sort of rolling horizon is a decade out. Because I think if my headlights are that far down the road, then I can set the service up as best I can to be ready for the future. I don't expect the combatant commander to do that. That's my job. So he employs the forces that we have this afternoon, and I want him focused on the near-term threats. I think the Secretary of Defense needs service chiefs focused down the road to make sure that we don't arrive at a place 4 or 5 years into the future and we find ourselves, we have the wrong force. We have the wrong concepts. Okay, so we should have our headlights down the road. And as you highlight, the Secretary sits right in the middle of that, as does the chairman, trying to not arbitrate, but trying to balance both the near-term readiness and the risk this afternoon with the long-term, make sure that the department's ready for what the future operating environment might look like. So I don't think anything is wrong there. I think it's a natural stasis of things where the secretary sits in the middle, as he rightly should, trying to balance the near-term needs with the long-term needs, all a natural state of things. So how do you, if you're a service chief or the commandant, then how do you set up the service for the future? I think the dialogue around, and you mentioned it, around deterrence and competition and what all that means is definitely worth unpacking over time. We haven't had a pacing threat in a long time. So just the dialogue of deterrence is sort of a new old discussion item, right? I mean, there's some veterans around who recall something about conventional and strategic deterrence, but it hasn't been a day-to-day topic for 20 years. So, okay, so we have some, go back to the history books, let's learn about how it was done. Today's a different environment, but absolutely there are lessons to be learned from history here. What does the Marine Corps do? I think a couple things. I think you need a forward sort of, we call it a stand-in force or a contact force. You need a very forward, expeditionary, fairly light, fairly mobile force all the time in the right areas if you're the United States, because that's how you're going to do a couple things. One, figure out what's going on in front of you. And this is a sort of reconnaissance, counter-reconnaissance effort. Somebody has to paint a picture of what in the world is going on in front of us. And you need a force forward to do that. I think satellites and everything else contribute, but there's great value in being forward. The second part is you can contribute to the deterrence in terms of making sure the adversary knows that you can see what they're doing. And this is sort of a developing topic of deterrence by detection. In other words, not just deterrence by punishment or the threat of punishment, but actually deterrence by detection, meaning they will have to change their scheme because they believe we can pretty much see what they're doing all the time. Okay, that's very valuable, I think. The response to crisis, whether that's a typhoon or, in other words, a natural disaster or a problem in a U.S. embassy or whatever it is, the U.S. has always been very good at getting there quickly with something to try to help out, to try to contain. I don't think that goes away in the future at all. And this is really the bread and butter of the Marine Corps as a naval force. Get there quickly, try to get a picture of it, try to buy time for the Joint Force Commander, for the national leadership to sort through what we're going to do. But you need something there quickly. And this is the value of a very ready Marine Corps as a crisis response force. So the deterrence aspect, I think, on the conventional side, we have work to do there as a joint force. The Marine Corps, Navy, I think, is uniquely suited to be forward all the time, be expeditionary, be on board ship. Doesn't require a big footprint to shore. All that, though, a lot of work still to do.
So picking up on that, thank you. That's a fantastic answer and gave me some new insights into how you see your priorities. I wanted to pick up where John Allen left off with, you know, mentioning that you're roughly halfway through what would be considered a classic 4-year tenure as service chief, and ask you to sort of assess how we're doing. It's also now about 3 years since Secretary Mattis's National Defense Strategy. That was the previous administration, of course, but it built on the Obama administration's third offset. And there seems a fair amount of continuity and agreement, at least on these matters of defense policy and the focus on great power competition. So it just seems like it's a good opportunity to take stock of how well we're doing. You mentioned we still have work to do as a joint force. I'm fairly impressed at how much you've gotten done in 2 years, but also I know that service chiefs usually feel that it's very hard to get things done quickly, and you've only got 4 years to do it. There are a lot of big ideas and big buzzwords out there. Again, the National Defense Strategy, the third offset. There's the joint all-domain command and control, building on multi-domain operations. All these things follow on from air-sea battle. My friend Harlan Ullman, who of course has followed these issues for many years, underscores that it's not always obvious how all the services fit into any one of these initiatives. So could you take a step back and maybe as one of the joint chiefs, not just the commandant, but one of the joint chiefs looking at the whole of defense establishment, sort of assess how we're doing and where we perhaps need to, you know, stick a little burr in our saddle, so to speak, and get going a little faster if we're really going to reinvigorate conventional deterrence.
The way we view it within the Marine Corps, and I think we're not alone. I think I won't speak for General Brown, C.Q. Brown, but we do talk a lot, he and I. I think that our sense is if you're comfortable with the rate of change right now, then you're moving too slow. And I don't say that lightly, and I don't say it just because we should move fast for the sake of moving fast, because moving fast, there's risk in that, right? Things are going to go wrong. You're going to try things that don't work out. But we are driven, I am driven by the pace at which our pacing threat is moving and technology is moving. And those two aspects are both key drivers for me in terms of the speed at which we must move. The NDS, I think your point is valid. I think the foundational elements of that strategy, what they saw as the operating environment, what the main threats were, I think all that doesn't actually change that much, to your point. I think it's valid today. That there, you would need to update it, and this administration is certainly going about that. I think we'll see, I believe we'll see a new one sometime late this year, early next year, and all that is, I think, natural, because that's 3 years later. You probably ought to look at it, see what's still valid and what needs updating. But the basics of it, I think, are there. Character of war, I think, is, you know, the premise of your question is the character of war fundamentally changing, and are we keeping up with it? I would say I'm frustrated that we're not recognizing early enough that the character of war is evolving, is changing, and we must evolve with it. We have not been in a place before where we had a peer adversary. In any part of the military or economic or diplomatic or any other lens you want to look through, we've been alone on top for so long that this is an uncomfortable place for us to be. We should be uncomfortable with that. But actually, I think it drives us in a direction, it will drive us in a direction that we will accept. And that is, an understanding of, okay, if we can't be in the front of the line in every area all the time, 24 hours a day around the world, if that's not achievable anymore, then we're actually going to have the discussion we ought to have, which is, where can we accept risk? In what areas, in other words, just as a military force, in what areas are we comfortable being behind? What areas do we need to be astride? What areas must we be in front? We have to maintain a margin of advantage there. Those are really hard discussions to have because we're used to being in front, on top, everywhere, all the time. Well, that's not the world that I see in front of us. So now comes the harder decisions about which ones are we comfortable actually being astride or maybe even a little behind in order to maintain an advantage in these other areas. Second part, I think, to that, I think the discussion that Secretary Austin and others are starting, and the term he uses is integrated defense or integrated deterrence. I think that's a great way of capturing what we ought to think about. Now, he talks about it, I believe, in terms of a whole of government sort of integrated approach, interagency and all the tools you got in the whole kit bag. But there's also an integrated part with our allies and partners and within the U.S. military. So there's at least two levels of integrated there that we really got to unpack, understand, because we are not going to be as successful on our own. We have to acknowledge the value of the allies and partners, which I think you could offer perhaps at times there was some hubris in terms of taking for granted. We can't not take it for granted. It has to be a work every day, every single day. I think as a Joint Chief, I think I wish we had changed. I wish we had started to move faster earlier. I'm uncomfortable with the pace. I'm uncomfortable with the amount of bureaucracy, to your point, that it takes to make a move. However, all that said, I am buoyed by a couple of things. One, young leaders in the Marine Corps who are not hesitating to move at all. They're frustrated with me. Like, they see where we need to go and they're like, you need to move the machine faster. So I'm really, as always, pushed by junior leaders who are ready to move. They see the world in front of them changing too, and they're ready to go. And frankly, also Congress, who I think wants to help the Marine Corps, wants to help the U.S. military move. Now, they know some of the bureaucracy, some of the friction they created. So I think they're working hard to try to help how they can, or in ways that are helpful, reduce the friction, reduce the bureaucracy, be able to move faster.
If you don't mind, I wanted to ask you about your gut feeling about China. And I know that there's probably a part of you as Commandant in the Marine Corps that would rather let somebody else answer that question in the government. But I'm also struck that if we look around the government, you know, there are people whose responsibilities like yours are very important in regard to China. And we may or may not be having a fulsome enough dialogue about what we think China really wants, what they're up to, and also which scenarios with China should worry us the most. And so I guess it's a two-part question. Part one would be, in your gut, do you feel like China is, you know, an ultra-ambitious rising power that's going to be very, very hard to deter without war? And your gut instinct is that the chances of war are very high. Or are you closer to feeling that if we're responsive and we do a lot of the things you're trying to do with the Marine Corps, the rise of China is probably something we have a pretty good chance working with allies to handle? And so that's sort of at a broad philosophical level. And I do think the answer is important, because I watch the Biden team and they're, you know, trying to find the right balance. And they have this concept of compete where you must, but cooperate where you can, confront only if essential. But then they've also designated China a perpetrator of genocide in Xinjiang province. And that's a pretty strong statement. And there are a lot of people in the defense world who really think that we will fight China someday, because rising powers fight established powers. And it's sort of, you know, Thucydides' trap, as Graham Allison had said. But I wanted to ask you where you come down. And then also, which scenarios, you know, to the extent that deterrence is hard and war is a possibility, which scenarios worry you most? Is it Taiwan or is it something else? So it's a big question, but I'd really love to hear your insight.
I read Graham's book like many people. China for me is a topic I've spent the last 10 years trying to learn as much as I can. And the more that I read and listen and study, the more it's clear to me it takes a lot of study because they're not an easy culture for us to see, because we want a mirror image, and you have to really discipline your mind to try to understand where they are. And the first step, of course, and I won't go far down this road, but we are comfortable talking about China and PRC and the Communist Party all as interchangeable. They are clearly not. So the learning, the discipline, the education part, I think first step is helpful. I am not there with those that believe that war is a foregone conclusion with China. I'm not in that camp. I think there are measures that both sides can take that don't make it something that's in inevitability. It's not. I don't believe that it is. That said, they clearly have a strategy. They have a plan. They are resourcing that plan. They have a unity of government that gives them an advantage. There are disadvantages in that also. I believe they're on a march to accomplish their ends, their objectives. And it's pretty clear, and they are very open about what those objectives are. As far as deterrence and competition, let me put it another way. Their ambitions, clearly, all you need to do is look at a map from 10 years ago and a map from today, and you can see what they're trying to do. We need to be in a position to hold the freedom of both the seas and the air and all domains, all aspects wide open, because that's where commerce flows. That's the benefit, and everybody's a benefactor there. A rewriting of the rules with a narrow set of controls on there is not to the good of the world. I don't think it's inevitable, but I do think it's going to be an active, everyday sort of competition for the foreseeable future. They are continuing to expand. We're trying to sort through how do we accommodate, but not allow any one nation to rewrite a set of rules that's done really well for everybody for 70 years in their favor, sort of thing. And that's, of course, the quandary. So I know it's very basic, but first step for me is continue to try to understand their culture, try to understand their goals, their objectives, their leadership, frankly, and the timelines that they are on, all the way to President Xi. And the timeline that he is on. Scenarios. You cannot talk about the global competition or what strategic competition without talking about Taiwan and where that fits in. But here, I think this is where it's too simple to look at Taiwan, China, and the U.S. in a symmetrical lens or a symmetrical. They're not. It's an asymmetric problem from a security aspect, and it's more than regional. So one, we got to open our brains a little bit and think it's not just how much firepower do they have versus us versus Taiwan, right? It's not so simple. I think we also sometimes skip past the fact that Taiwan is responsible for Taiwan's defense. Okay, well, that we can't skip past that first step. So how can we help them defend themselves? Not skip past that first step. I think two different scenarios, in other words, broadly. One is the inch by inch, yard by yard movement forward that we see in the areas like the South China Sea and in other areas where I'm just going to use sort of a martial arts metaphor where if you lean back, they lean forward. Okay, that's the everyday cabbage salami slice, whatever kind of, you know, characterization you want to use that works in their favor because there's no fight there. They just move forward a little bit at a time. But the other part is a more dynamic, a more kinetic, perhaps, scenario like Taiwan, where it's clearly in their interest. And they have stated so overtly that they want to bring Taiwan underneath the umbrella. And that's going to be counter to so far to our U.S. policy. So I think you look at them through different lenses, the everyday, every week competition versus what are the set of circumstances by which the PRC might move towards Taiwan and what might that look like?
Now, Chris Rose, former staff to John McCain, wrote a book called The Kill Chain that's been very well received. And he quotes a series of Pentagon war games in which we supposedly, you know, simulated conflict against China over Taiwan. And according to Bros, the United States lost 17 times in a row. I wondered if you could help us unpack that and just how dire is that warning? I mean, just to throw in one of my own thoughts quickly, if I could, that I've sometimes therefore concluded that we need to think like Secretary Austin about more integrated deterrence across the full range of tools of government and also the full geographic range of where we could perhaps, in the event that China blockades Taiwan, we essentially do something like a blockade of China. Now, maybe it's not quite as airtight as China could blockade Taiwan, but we could interfere with shipping in the Indo-Pacific region over towards the Persian Gulf. We could combine that with economic sanctions, try to convince as many of our allies as possible to place a form of economic punishment on China rather than trying to directly go into the dragon's lair, so to speak, and break the blockade 100 miles off the coast of China where it's being applied against Taiwan. Is there anything that you would add to specifics on this kind of a conversation, or is this too sensitive and classified, or is this not really a productive way in your mind for the United States to just try to expand our options for dealing with a possible war over Taiwan?
I think one you highlight is an acknowledgement and acceptance that we should be prepared for it if the People's Republic, if the PRC were to decide that, okay, this is the time and we have to try to seize Taiwan now, we should clearly accept that that's going to probably go into all domains and it probably will be wider than regional. It may not be, but we should be prepared for it. Absolutely should. So the basics, in other words, the old style of how do you contain, how do you prevent a seizure of Taiwan will probably not applicable going forward because there are capabilities in other domains that weren't there before. And things that are frankly to be determined in some like space, where how far any nation will go because the rules are not yet written for sort of the international sort of rule of how things will work in that domain. I think we are adjusting the way that we look at any potential conflict over Taiwan. And that, I would agree with you 100%, has to go into all much beyond the military and much beyond US versus PLAN. Has to be a wider conversation than that. I think the basics, the way that Secretary Austin and others have characterized what is it about deterrence, or what is deterrence that we are actually after in conventional means. And that is really about the calculus in their head, you know, the cost benefit sort of calculus where they're convinced that the risk is not worth taking that next step. So how do we best achieve that? Here, the last part I'll mention is regardless of whether it's Taiwan or another scenario, time will matter. If you can't get there quickly to begin to address an issue, every hour, every day is going to compound the issue. And that's the same in the Middle East or in the Mediterranean or in the Indo-Pacific. So having a forward force, having something in proximity really does help the United States. Lastly, I'll just turn it on its head completely upside down. Let's say it's not a war fight, but a typhoon, or you name the disaster. Could be an earthquake. Customarily, the U.S. has been nearby and sent help really quickly. Well, the PLAN, the People's Republic of China, is shrinking the size of their army, growing the size of their Navy and Marine Corps for a reason. We're going to have to think through what if they get there first with medical supplies, with the ability to help ashore without bringing a whole brigade ashore. How do we factor all that in? Because the relationship with allies and partners is also built on how we respond to natural disasters when the call for help goes out. What if we're not first? That's never been the case before. So back to the, you know, how do you use the force to your advantage? How do you develop the relationship with allies and partners? Some of it clearly is training and interoperability and the kinetic aspects, but some of it, frankly, is using their tools plus yours in a way that can help mankind when needed. it's not the first place most people talk in the military, but my experience is when a country needs help and they need it now, every day, every hour matters.
Fantastic. And thank you for bringing in a broader range of concerns and scenarios and natural disasters. That leads a little bit to, I'm going to start to bring in more questions from the audience, although I've already been doing so to sort of buttress and expand on some of my own. But one question is about the recent Northern Edge exercise and whether the Marine Corps learned useful insights about the expeditionary advanced base operations, where you've been in favor of trying to make us much more supple and be smaller and maybe more resilient in a number of our potential basing options around the broader Indo-Pacific in particular. So what did we learn from Northern Edge and about the expeditionary advanced base operations concept?
Couple things. One, logistics matters. The more dispersed, the more distributed you are, logistics challenges go up. We know that. Everybody who's studied any kind of military history understands that. But it's compounded when you're facing an adversary. So it's not the sustainment of that force over great distances really becomes challenging if your lines of communication, your supply lines, can be threatened. We're not comfortable with that. We haven't had our supply lines, our operational strategic supply lines, we haven't had them threatened since World War II, I would offer. So this is new territory for us as well. So first of all, we have work to do on logistics as a joint force, as a Marine Corps. Everybody's focused on missiles and rockets and aircraft and joint all domain command and control, all of which is relevant, all of which is not going to go very far if we don't address the logistics early on now. So that's one part of it. Operating in extreme environs, especially in the Arctic and the North, brings an additional set of environmental factors that you don't face in other places. Great, in other words, to train in Alaska, great to train in Norway. Why? Because there are days when you can't launch and recover aircraft. There are days when you're weathered in, when you have to figure out, both sides are facing the same environment, but it's a real challenge. The machinery works different. Human beings work different. And this is May, right, when the Northern Edge is going on. You work in that environment in December, January, February, it's a whole nother aspect to it. We, training in a extreme cold weather, training in the Arctic is really important. Why? Because it, for our concepts, second, for our equipment, third, for our people, all changing environments like that and operating in there is very, very good. Expeditionary advanced base ops, back to where I started. You can have all the mobility and all the lethality you want. If you can't sustain it, you're gonna culminate pretty early. So we have to focus on the logistical aspects. That's not easy. It's solvable, but we got to put our shoulder into it.
Thank you. There are a couple of questions about acquisition policy and innovation policy in the Marine Corps. You referred to how many young officers often want to drive things faster than the institutional Marine Corps can keep up with them, so to speak. And I know that former Chairman Mac Thornberry really pushed acquisition reform at the House Armed Services Committee. And of course, we've broken up the undersecretary position for acquisition into two pieces to try to spur things at that level as well. So the question specifically, one is, does the Marine Corps need to create some kind of an innovation ecosystem or office that would help expedite the development of new technology? And then the other is, are you able to sort of get through the so-called acquisition valley of death better than before, where an idea might look promising, but then getting it enough money to get into more advanced development prior to a decision on, actual full development and procurement, can be often a difficult period for a weapon system. So that's a bunch of stuff on acquisition reform. I wondered if you would comment, please.
Two parts that if I picked up on you on the question, two main parts. The first part, should we create some sort of innovation ecosystem? Here, I will thank, we are the benefactors today of decisions made 20, 30 years ago in the Marine Corps. Location wise, the Marine Corps relocated It's manpower, it's systems command where we do all of our acquisition. It's warfighting lab, it's combat development. It relocated all that to Quantico, Virginia. So within a 5-mile radius, every part to make speed, every part that you want is right there. So we're not in different towns or different states. That allows us velocity, I would say, enables us to move much quicker, more agile than my peers who are, they're spread across the United States. We're all within 5-6 miles. Ecosystem. I would offer that we have it. Now, it may not satisfy everybody. Ours is the central node of that is the warfighting laboratory, which is in Quantico, Virginia. Those are the people who are testing out ideas, concepts, equipment through the fleet, through the operating forces themselves. They're co-located in Quantico, Virginia. They're co-located with our acquisition arm, Marine Corps Systems Command, and the program manager for land forces, or PEO land systems. So everything is in Quantico. That helps. Are we moving fast enough? No. Are the bright minds pushing us? Yes, but I'll just use one example. I'm convinced that our infantry battalion is not built right for the future, but I also don't know what the perfect infantry battalion ought to look like. So our approach is, how we're going to learn fast is we have 3 Marine divisions. Each one of them selected 1 battalion, organized differently, trained differently, equipped differently through the warfighting lab. And for the next year and a half, 2 years, as they go through their regular cycle of train and then go deploy overseas, come back, we'll learn from all 3. My guess is none of those 3 is the perfect solution, but 3 different configurations with 3 different concepts and 3 different sets of gear. We're going to, in a year and a half, 2 years, we're going to have the best picture we have of what's the infantry battalion look like going to the future. This is what you have to do. I think also I would just add, we got to be comfortable getting out of the way sometimes between industry, engineers, and Marines. We always want to get in the middle of the conversation. We always want to ask questions because the program manager wants to know what's going on and all of us are interested. And sometimes a lieutenant or a corporal or a sergeant and an engineer, if you just step back and watch, they'll actually come up with ways of doing things that nobody had envisioned prior to that. You just got to be comfortable with some failures along the way. We should be comfortable with that. Turn them loose. If it doesn't work out the way we designed it, fine. Is there another use for it? Maybe there is. So in some aspects, we got to get out of our own way. The Valley of Death, the second part, we absolutely have to figure that part out. We have a good idea. Somewhere in the middle between that and a formal program or record, it sort of dies on the vine. Here, Quantico, I think, helps us again because they're co-located in the same place. So the first part, the warfighting lab and the equipment that we're experimenting with and trying out is in the same grid square almost as the acquisition arm. So they're co-located. They're talking because they're co-located. So I think we have fewer problems with the Valley of Death than perhaps my peers in some ways. We have 1 acquisition command. We have 1 warfighting lab, and it's all co-located. But the point, I think, is absolutely valid. Otherwise, great ideas just die. They have nowhere. They can't find a home. They just die.
You know, speaking of different structures and mechanisms that might be set up, I want to come back one more time to China, and then I'll have a final question from the audience as we already approached the 11 o'clock hour and what's just been a great experience for me. And I'm so grateful, but I wanted to ask a commandant if you feel like we have the right system in the US government to think about China in a broad sense. So Secretary Austin's talking about integrated deterrence involving cyber and economics and diplomacy, but of course he doesn't control all those aspects of the US response. And when I've looked into how we could use economic warfare along with warfighting strategies and gone over to Treasury, for example, to talk about what kind of capacity they would have to help build that kind of a strategy, you know, they're very small in terms of their international office. And the National Security Council already is probably too big and already asked to do too much. And the combatant commands, as you say, are often at least as focused on the near term as on thinking about the long-term future. So as we try to, you know, follow your vision or Secretary Austin's vision, which are complementary, I think, of a long-term strategy for a rising great power like China, do we have the right place in the government that's working that problem, whether it's the Joint Staff or the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy? But again, even those are just the military side of things. Do we need to rethink how we do this at a government-wide level?
It could potentially be the National Security Council, and I think it's too early to pass judgment. Their team, you know, 3 months, whatever it is, 3-4 months into it, I think it's premature to say that can't be done there with the agility that we need. We talk, like you have the same back, you know, history as I do. We talk about interagency like it's a thing. It's not a thing. You clearly need a centerpiece, a pivot man, whatever you want to call it, that can fuse all those aspects together to get the whole of government that we're seeking, that we search for. I think too early to tell I'm not the one to pass judgment, but my sense is too early to tell. If it does become big and bloated and slow and cumbersome, then that'll really crush us. On the other hand, if it thins itself out, leans itself to the point where the different elements of our government can actually work through there, then it could be the place. But for the first time, I think the driver is not for myself. I'm just talking about myself. We've looked at our government internally and how do we make ourselves better. But for the first time, really, we're being pushed by a unitary government that's about a peer. Okay, they have speed. They have, if it's all the powers in a single person, we haven't been pressed by that kind of a strategic challenge before. So I think that's pressing us to your point, to figure out how to be more agile, to figure out how to streamline, to figure out how to fuse all that together. The chairman, the joint staff, policy, they will clearly fill a role within the Pentagon. They're not the centerpiece for how to stitch together the all of government that you're hinting at.
I certainly wish Kurt Campbell and the other parts of the team at the NSC well. I do think it's a daunting task for the NSC, given that it's small. Yeah, but thank you. And so my final question, again, really synthesizing and combining a couple of questions from the audience, have to do with how do you find a way for the Corps to do it all? Because you and I have been talking about great power competition and modernization. We began with, and you commented, I think, fairly favorably on how the Corps has dealt with COVID and the recovery from budgetary problems and high deployments of earlier years. But do you have concerns that as you're being asked to address China's rise and the return of great power competition, that you may not be able to do quite as well some of the other lower intensity and more diverse tasks that remain important, whether it's in regard to Iran or terrorism or any other challenge? North Korea, we haven't talked too much about today. Are there any other concerns that you would have where it's important not to let our vigilance and our preparedness slip, even as we have this new priority on great power competition? Over to you for the final answer of the day, sir.
There is a risk of that. If we don't discipline ourselves, I'd agree. In other words, you can lose your focus and then try to become all things to all. And then that's how organizations get themselves in trouble. I think my job is to help keep the Corps focused. We are by nature and by, I think, unique role, a crisis response force for the nation. Okay, that must stay in the center because you never know when the next crisis is going to happen or where. You need something you can put at the problem very quickly. It may not be the perfect fit, the right wrench for the right bolt, but get something there fast, sort it out, buy us time. This is the Marine Corps' role, and that requires a very high state of readiness. The second part, after the crisis response, is understand our role in strategic competition, in great power competition. And our role, I think, is be forward. Try to make sense of what's going on in front of us, have a level of the lethality that can hold an adversary at risk where we need to, when we need to. but not try to be everywhere all the time or all things to all people. No, I am very confident that if you build a force that's targeted at a certain level, your pacing threat in our case, that any Marine commander can take that force and go to some other mission. It may not be the perfect fit, but he'll be able to adjust. The inverse is not true. If you build a force that's solely counterinsurgency or solely crisis response, low end of the conflict, they cannot scale up to a higher end against a higher, much more capable adversary. That's how your casualties go through the roof. So my aim point is a pacing threat. Build the, in terms of capabilities and concepts, use that as our pacing threat. Stay focused. Don't try to be everything to everybody.
General Berger, thank you very much for the time today. Thanks for all you're doing, you and your men and women around the world in the Marine Corps. It's really an honor for us at Brookings. And I know, again, my good friend John Allen and the whole team are very grateful for the time you spent with us today. So we will now sign off from Brookings. Thank everyone else for being part of this conversation as well, including the questions from the audience, and wish folks a great rest of the spring and beyond as we hopefully start to emerge from this COVID shutdown as well. So thank you again. Very best wishes, everybody, and signing off from Brookings.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you very much.